you are one of us. Your passion is the world of mountain biking, from enduro to gravel races and everything in between. This is Insider MTB, the podcast that takes you behind the handlebars, into the dirt, and behind the scenes of the mountain biking world. And now your host, Austin White.
Episode 11, Spencer's favorite intro. I don't know how much fucking better it could get right there. I'm Austin White, Spencer Rathkamp with us. This is a little bit of an Olympic 2024 Paris talk. Spencer, what's up?
Olympics are back, and we have a couple seats as the U.S., but I don't know. Yeah, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. We got some cool guests on to discuss all things cross-country. And,
your favorite.
Yeah, all that whole vibe. But no, man, things are good. We're here. We got another episode rolling, and we got a lot to look forward to.
How long did you do like cross country?
That was what I got into. That's how I got into mountain biking, and I raced cross country stuff for like 4 or 5 years or something, and decided I couldn't go. I didn't decide, but I had a buddy of mine that races in the Tour and stuff, Tour de France, that I was training with. He was like, hey man, in order for you to climb like these guys. Yeah, he was just real with me, and I respect him forever for that. Yeah, he told me, stop wasting my time. I have to lose weight and dedicate so much of my life to be able to climb like the cross country guys can, but I could already drop them all in the descent. So he's like, just lean into something else. But I don't know. I can't completely give it up. I'll still race a couple cross country races every now
okay,
and then.
Okay, so but like back then,
yeah,
was the courses like they are now? Because like in the U.S., it's kind of tamed down compared to...
Well, I've never raced a World Cup.
Okay.
Never. Oh. I've raced the Rio Olympic course. I did an event 2 weeks before the Olympics, a test event there. And the course was pretty gnarly. It was pretty technical.
Really?
It was fun. It was super fun. Super man-made.
But that's like right up your alley.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. That's great. If all courses were like that, I probably would have been a little better cross country racer. But unfortunately, here in the U.S., for the most part, trying to change things. Ty Cady's big proponent in getting stuff a little more technical in here. And there were a few races like Missoula, Montana, the Missoula XC race that were a little more technical and not as roadie focused, because that's how a lot of the races are here in the States. It's the strongest person wins, where that should be fairly true, but you should also be a good bike rider. And sometimes a lot of the Americans aren't necessarily the greatest bike riders because they spend all their time on the road and just drilling themselves.
Is that kind of like why Nino was he 38? 37, I'm not 100% sure, but like he's able to still kind of just slip in some of those wins right now. Like,
oh, I mean, Nino's an insane bike rider. There's a famous trail in Laguna Beach, California here, called PGs. You might have seen a video going viral just a couple weeks ago of some guy going off a famous drop that is pretty death defying. And if you don't make the left hand turn, I didn't think it was possible to survive, but somebody just survived it last week. He went off the edge. Anyways, maybe in post or something, you could put that video in or something, but it's crazy. But anyways, I might be messing the story up a little bit, and we can have one of these guys on in the future to clarify, but yeah. Hans No Way Ray was, I mean, he needs no introduction basically. And Brian Lopes, also extremely talented bike rider, very, very, very successful. And, they bet Nino like a grand a piece, I think, that he could not ride PGs without a dropper post. By riding high posted, and Nino Schurter has ridden PGs high posting before.
Shut up. Is there a video?
I think it was probably before social media was really a thing, but yes. Yeah, so Let me tell you, I would be absolutely terrified to even try this trail without a drop post. It's crazy. And that's just goes to show you how talented that Nino is. And a lot of these cross country guys are, especially at the high end. I mean, you have to be a great bicycle rider and a great bike handler like Chris Blevins is. And some of those other guys, I mean, Keegan Swenson was on our last episode. I mean, you got to be able to ride a bike well, to race and be successful in World Cups.
But I would say like Blevins is fucking amazing on a bike as well. Like if you just took away XC, the dude's
that's what I just
talented.
That's yeah, literally yeah. what I just said. Yeah,
but some,
yeah.
but I'm, I mean, yeah, totally. But I mean, like compared to some of the others, I would like if let's just do your top five of actually gnarly talented. If you didn't have XC, would we put like Blevins and Nino up in that area of in the top five?
Oh man, that's so. I don't even know if I could build a Mount Rushmore. I mean. Like,
well,
not on
wins, but just like technically. Like
no,
this,
I know. Yeah, I mean, okay, yeah. Or are you gonna put? I don't know. That's
you would have
so
to give it to Nino
hard.
For writing that without a dropper post, almost. But like maybe if we just challenge Blevins to it next time we have it on.
Yeah.
Hey, bud. I mean, we got a challenge for you.
Yeah, literally. But then I don't know. I mean, would you put it? Almost feels weird or wrong to be put a Nino Schurter next to Brandon Semenuk or something of like in a technical sense, but who knows? Maybe
we need
a
unique race that brings them all together.
Dude, I kind of want to do that because yeah, I feel like I could succeed in something like that.
You could
do like a stage race where you have to ride a road bike, race a road bike on one day and then a mountain bike and a XC downhill enduro cyclocross. Like you have to race every type of BMX bike.
Do you go to the level though of like, is it Red Bull Rampage at some moment you got to do a trick, or is it just like a downhill
maybe
race?
I don't know. Yeah, I've honestly never told anybody about that, but I've wanted to do a video series of some sort about that where I race the
like
highest level
Sea Otter
athletes. No.
I know,
no.
I'm just saying,
like more refined, like head-to-head. Me against Chris Blevins. Okay, we're going to race a cross-country race today, see how much I lose by, and then we're going to race a downhill race the next day and see how much I win or lose by. And then based off of the time differences, you kind of score and see how level we are or do a bunch of different disciplines. I don't know. It's just something. It'd be cool because I'd love to do something like that, just challenge myself against all of the best. You know.
And that's kind of maybe why like Blevins does like a Downeyville, right? Like, because he has some of those skills of that and still other skills as well, right?
Keegan smoked everybody. I mean, Chris won the downhill stage, I think, last year, but he just rode with his girlfriend on the cross-country portion of it. But Keegan smoked everyone on that.
What is the downhill? Year. Like, if you had to rank a downhill portion, at Sea Otter. I'm sorry, not Sea Otter. I'm talking Downeyville. What level of, like, suspension and riding technical? Like, I don't know, like, enduro, but he did it on an Epic Evo. You know what I'm saying? Like,
no, it's down country. It's
it is down country though. I've never been. Yeah. Sorry.
It's not, I mean, there's like two sections that are 10 seconds in total that are like really rowdy.
Like you need 150 and above. Like what rowdy are we talking here?
Man, none of it needs anything more than like a 130 bike at most really for all of it. For that race, it's just so long. It's 45 minutes is like some of the best times, from top to bottom with 1200 or 800 vertical climbing, something like that throughout. Everyone's just pushing the limit in terms of weight. They want the lightest tires and the lightest everything.
Yeah.
So you just have to be a little more careful, but a 130, 140 bike's the most fun bike in Downeyville.
And you're for sure doing Downey, so
I don't think I'm going to now. Actually,
you got to do that to me, you know?
Yeah.
So you're not in?
Nah, I'm gonna go film instead. I got an entry, but I'm gonna go film something.
Okay,
instead.
So then if you were doing Downeyville on that new Stumpy, are we talking Epic Evo?
No, Epic Evo, 100%.
Really? It's just because of climbing and just like the battle, like the
push. Yeah. The Epic Evo is like made for that bike for sure,
or for that race.
Event. It's the best bike for that for sure because it's so capable and still climbs like a rocket. The new Stumpy, albeit an insane bike, it's just not an XC bike. So climbing that 145, 150 bikes, I mean, you can. It'd be fun. It'd be a. If I was just going up to Downeyville for the weekend to ride, I would ride that for sure. Nope. It'd be so fun. But
I guess I need to go. How far is Downeyville from us?
6 hours. I don't know. Maybe even more than that.
And like, it's what are those trails on a regular day?
Super or do they fun? Like? There's so much. I mean, there's better riding than the actual Downeyville downhill.
Is it kind of like there. Kernville?
More rocky in the trees. It's 7 hours from us right now.
Maybe a little traffic. I mean, it's 3:30 on a
Wednesday. Before July 4th.
Maybe a little traffic around here.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. And yeah, there's probably going to be traffic up in Sacramento right now. But anyways, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, not to get off topic, but yeah. Yeah, like,
there's great riding up there. It's I don't know. It's Downeyville. It's like a mellow. It's the same terrain as like a TDS. It's very like mountainous.
TDS.
Same terrain. Same
okay, terrain. Sorry. Okay,
the but terrain. You're in trees. You're forested the whole time. Okay. And yeah, they're super, super, super fast trails. Like in the third divide and stuff down at the bottom, the last few sections, you are just absolutely nuking. And there's a section called Baby Heads that's full of just like boulders, little boulders that is pretty fast. But it's incredible. It's such a sick event. I don't know. Maybe I'll change.
You have to climb it. You don't have to climb it, right?
In the race, yeah.
So you start at the bottom, climb up, and then go.
It's a point to point race. The first day of Downeyville is an XC race. It's 24 miles, something like that, with like 4,200 feet of climbing, I think, something like that. You start right out of the gun with a 3,000 foot, 3 mile climb, I think is like the number. So it's like an hour directly out of the gate climbing, maybe a little less than that. I don't know. It's like an hour of climbing right off the rip. It takes like people like 2 hours, two and a half hours to finish the XC race, I think, typically. Unless you're Keegan Swenson.
negative time, actually. They give you time back.
Yeah. And then once you get to the top, you're more or less descending the whole rest of the day. But there's still some climbing and you're on the pedals a lot. And the following day, you have to do the downhill portion, which is 80% the same trail. There's just a few. You start off from the top a little differently than they do in the XC race, and you have to do it on the same bike. They weigh the bike before the XC day, and they weigh the bike before the downhill day, so it has to weigh the same. I mean,
yeah, were people like throwing some more weight or something in there to help for the downhill, or like what are we talking here?
You can't, because it has to weigh the same.
I know, but
the number has to be.
They obviously started it for a reason. That's kind of
For sure. I mean, you. You would want to run the lightest possible tire setup and everything on the XC bike on the XC day, and then throw some beefier tires on for the downhill day just to hit stuff a little bit harder. Yeah, I mean, that would make sense, but they prevent that. But yeah, it's all mountain, unofficial all mountain world championships, because it's supposed to bring the best all mountain rider out.
Why did you have to fuck it up and not go? I was going to... Maybe we should have done a video now at it. Now I'm thinking like, damn, maybe I should have gone.
It's in 10 days. Maybe I'll still go. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, on that rigorous training program you're on right now, right?
I'll be fine.
Yeah. You're good. You're drinking a Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is sponsoring you in the background. I mean, you're good
That's
to
right,
go.
They should.
Yeah, team player over here.
That's right.
Dude, but first off, like, what about the trails right now, man? Like, they're a little fucking dusty and a little bit dry and a little... fucking good, overgrown, man. Right?
Summer, it sucks. I mean, it it's so hot. I think, let me see right now. It is 99 degrees at my house right now. Summer's here. SoCal summers are rough. It's like impossible to ride in the middle of the day, even though I try.
That's why we're doing the podcast right now.
Yeah. But all the growth is now starting to die off. So it's weed whacking season, snake season down here. And I don't know. How about you? You've been riding?
No. I mean, I've just been riding park, dude. All I ride is park.
Oh, yeah. You've been out Big there. Mountain. How was Enduros? Angel Fire?
You know, I've never been there, but fuck, another 9,000-foot damn base mountain was rough for a little bit. I was hurting. After day three, it was just survive.
That mountain's cool, though, huh?
Yeah. No, the trails are pretty cool. The backcountry stuff that they opened up just for the BME was pretty rad. Reminded me a lot of Sunrise-style stuff. Yeah, I mean, I don't know, like that lift, and I was asking all the athletes, I was like, is this the longest lift to the top you've ever rode? It just seems like it goes forever.
Straight up the mountain. Yeah. Well,
yeah, you rode the lift, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't it seem like the longest one? Like, I want to calculate the distance. I don't know. It seems weird.
It is long, and it goes up to, what, 11,000, 12,000 feet?
Yeah, like, and those are some pretty long trails there.
Yeah, and it's rough, man.
Yeah, it was actually pretty good for this one. It wasn't that rough.
Oh, really good.
Yeah, no, it was like almost perfect berms. I blew a fucking spoke out. I was slapping the berm so hard, you know, next level.
I'm sure.
Professional athlete, trainer, me over here.
Why didn't I see the clips?
Budget cuts.
Okay, gotcha. Can I ask you something quick? What are our thoughts about old Colty P stirring the pot?
Woo!
Colty P. That brought some people out of the woodworks. I love it.
It did. Yeah. I mean, we don't have enough time to go into that topic. Maybe we do another podcast on that. Why actually, not? I think we should. Well, we're about to go into the Olympic talks. I would actually love to talk about it a little bit. It's quite interesting because me and you both have a little bit difference of opinion on it for sure.
Yeah.
So I think it'd be a great podcast. I would like to do one. I think we should do one with maybe some racers, some other people on the other sides of the scenes, like maybe veterans slash younger racers, you know, because they all had different opinions. And I think this past weekend at BME, I know that the top rows all ended up having like a 2-hour long conversation between each other. And it got a little interesting.
Yep.
I know that. I just don't know, you know, like it's competitive. it's just what it is, right? Like, I don't know what to say. This is what it takes to win. And if you're not willing to go to that lengths, it does suck. But that's the lengths that it's going to win. Right. I mean, fuck. Like I said, you're going to sign up on an Epic Evo and go for it.
Yeah. We have different opinions. That's
we do.
Sure.
I mean, we do
slightly. Yeah. I get it, but, I get your side slightly, but at the same time,
slightly, I'll take that win, dude. I will take that big brother, little brother win right there.
At the same time, it's about fairness and yeah, not all people are in the position that some of these,
why don't we talk about Aiden slipping in the shower and giving himself a concussion on Thursday night?
Did that happen?
Yes.
No way.
Yes. He's probably going to be pissed that I'm blowing him out right now, which I don't know if he listens to the podcast. Yeah, he got himself a concussion in the shower. First he comes over. Yeah, on Sunday he was like, I was like, man, why is he kind of riding like shit? Like, and he's like, dude, I got a concussion. I'm like, dude, you raced? And then,
oh, poor guy.
Someone was like, yeah, tell him how it happened. And I was like, oh, dude, did you fucking wad it? And he was like, in the shower.
No way.
It was rough. In the shower. Poor dude.
Oh, yeah. I didn't hear that.
Yeah. You got to hit him up with a little text on that. Yeah. So that's pretty rough. Like almost take yourself out, not even racing. And then but luckily how the points work this year, he didn't lose as much.
Yeah.
That would have been like a 400 fucking point swing back in the day. But yeah.
Yeah. Where did he finish?
7th.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's not that bad.
Yeah. Totally.
I just saw typically he's been Mr. Second Place all year. So I know. I was curious to see.
Yeah, we had a different little shakeup there for sure. But we got our first guest here. I'm going to add him in. Right. Jonathan. Now, look at that studio.
Look at that setup.
Wow.
Factory. Guys.
What's going on, buddy?
Factory. I love that. No, I don't think I've ever had anybody describe my podcast setup as factory. That shows that you're my people.
Dude, well, seriously. It looks great.
Yeah. Holy crap. What camera do you have right now? What is it? I'm going to have to look.
It's an A6500 setup with like a 50 mil. Okay. And then the lighting's all set up in here. I mean, yeah, like a big part of what we do here at Trainer Road, like a big part of it is the podcast in terms of the marketing efforts that we do. We're a bootstrapped company. We don't have investors. We don't operate in the sense that we have like a quarterly budget that we just have to spread out and allocate. Instead, it's like we test. If it works, we put more into that. And as a result, we have an unorthodox approach to marketing. And one of them that we put a lot of gas on is the podcast. So it's all set up.
I mean, look at that studio. I get it. Damn.
Yeah.
Holy crap. So, that looks good.
So simple, but it looks great.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow.
All right. Well, our first guest up this evening, whatever time it is Jonathan Lee of Trainer Road. Is that the best way to introduce you, I guess? Or
absolutely.
Cyclist, absolutely. Obviously, you know, a better training program than my e-bike one. So yeah, I'm going to need some hot tips right now. Can I put that on the trainer? Does it work out? Do you actually have that type of shit happening? Do people ask you that question there?
Yeah, actually, it's kind of funny. I mean, just e-bikes have blown up, right? In terms, and it's so awesome. I don't know. Somebody's probably listening to this and hates e-bikes, but I just love it. I think it's the coolest thing that's happened to mountain biking and cycling in general. And tons of people, are like, hey, can I use my e-bike on the trainer? And it's cool because a lot of the people that they're asking those questions to, there are support agents, and so many of them are athletes. In fact, like one of them, Tiffany, she just qualified for the Olympics to go represent South Africa for the road race. She's just amazing. And like, we have like legit athletes and they're answering these people and being like, yeah, absolutely, man. Like, put your e-bike on there. Wait. Do it. Whatever you need to do. You know what I mean? It's cool. I think that's what we should do.
I had no idea you could even, I mean, would you want to though? Is it?
I don't know. It's like teach their own, but
I don't know if I would do that. And I'm like a big supporter of e-bikes. So like that's, well, I guess you just need
days,
one bike.
More than anything, we're less and less like just indoor training. You know, it's like you can do all the stuff that our AI generates for you, all the workouts and training plans. You just do them outside and they send to your Garmin or your Wahoo or your Hammerhead or whatever it is. And you just do them outside. So
for sure, question for you then on that is how many people that are going to the Olympics or top athletes, I guess, are on the trainer road programs?
So we don't pay any athletes.
But I mean, that you know of using it, maybe. How about that?
But yeah, you know, I don't have a count, but I do know that we've seen like we've seen they've reached out to us and let us know that they use it, or they've asked if we can sponsor them. And yeah, it's way more common than people would think. You know, we're about 100-person company, which I think surprises a lot of people too.
That dude, that's huge. Really
small shop, yeah. But we're nowhere near as big as, you know, something like, I don't know, like a Training Peaks. You know, they're a very different business with like coaches and all that stuff. But
yeah.
We have a lot of people that race at the world tour level or that. So I shouldn't say a lot. I'm just going to be very general to not imply or cause any sort of misunderstanding. Oh, no. There are definitely multiple people that use Trainer Road at the very high level to train. So it's pretty cool.
Incredible.
Yeah, seriously. Okay. Then I feel like maybe how long have you been at Trainer Road, I guess?
It's been it's been almost 12 years. So basically since the beginning, more or less. So yeah, when we didn't even, I remember like it was just like Starbucks at first meeting up, and then like it was a co-working space and we felt super official, like, you know, leasing a desk at a co-working space or having a membership. And then then leasing offices. Now we have our awesome office here in Reno, but our employees are all over the world to get the best engineers and stuff. You know, some of them might live in France or might live in South Africa or Australia or wherever they may be.
So. Okay. Wow. All right. So then, okay. How much of those do you see, like, let's just, you see some data helps with training for the Olympics. And then I guess it's not just they started last week. It's been probably years in changing their program to get towards the Olympics, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. So you're like athlete trajectory, basically, on getting toward the Olympics is what we're talking. Yeah, man, I feel like there's so much that gets in the way of an athlete getting to the Olympics before just talking about their training program in terms of all the barriers that you have to hop over. I mean, Spencer, you're an example of like an outstanding talent on a bike, I feel like. And but even you ran into, and you didn't become some, you know, national level, elite level champion, right? But you, in terms of like Cat 1 sort of stuff, you're absolutely there and always there. An athlete, even with your talent though, you still bump into barriers. So like what these athletes bump into, it's just, it's a lot. Like getting to the Olympics, you have to have the genetic lottery, you have to have the work ethic lottery, the mindset lottery, then you have to have the team of people around you to be able to support all of that.
Your chef.
And then honestly, you have to have some luck. Like, you know, you look at it right now, Bjorn Riley is an incredible mountain biker, but he's not going to the Olympics for the USA right now. Kate Courtney, she's an incredible mountain biker, but she's not going to the Olympics right now. And it's, you know, a lot of it comes down to your country, how many points you've amassed over a certain period of time. That defines how many people your country can send. And hopefully you've amassed a lot of points. But then on top of that, if you have, it's probably because you have a lot of competition to be selected. So it's just, you really have to run the gauntlet. But in terms of training to get there, Yeah, I mean, for a cross country Olympic, like what we're talking about here, these are like really special athletes, and you do have to build the sort of base for so many years. You have to build this aerobic foundation that allows you to then every year you can raise the stakes and raise the level a little bit more and a little bit more, and just incrementally get yourself up to a truly world-class level. So, I mean, yeah, it takes a lot. That's for sure.
So, okay. So not all of our viewers or listeners might know about Trainer Road. So I'd like to give you an opportunity to step back in this conversation, at least for a second, and maybe introduce in your own words what Trainer Road is, what your involvement with Trainer Road is and has been from the beginning, and what you guys really do and what you're trying to achieve with it.
Yeah, for sure. Put it simply, we use AI to make cyclists faster. And the way that we do that is by bringing in all the data that athletes use to train. And when they sync all their data, then our system understands it, analyzes all their performance, and tells them what workout they should do to get faster the next day. So it's pretty cool. It's really advanced. For a long time, we started out and we were just an indoor training tool, right? And where it's like you would pair your power meter or your trainer over to Trainer Road, and then you'd see your data up on there and you could get in structured workouts. And then smart trainers came along. That was really cool and an innovation. But the whole time we were sitting back there and thinking about this grand vision of like, let's find the best way to make a person faster. And the way that we can do that, we're actually in an advantageous position because we have all this data. It's really well structured in a controlled environment. It's not a laboratory, but all these people are training inside. It's relatively controlled. And if we can get a lot of data that's really well structured like this, and then bring in additional data outside of that from all the other stuff that other people do when they're riding, not just like nailing intervals to the T, but when they're racing, when they're riding, whatever else they're doing. If you can bring all that in, we should be able to train models on that that might be able to decide how to give you a better workout than a human would. And that's the goal. So it started out as an indoor tool. It's become much more than that. It's really like, you know, the most, our goal, we're aiming to be the cycling's most effective training system across the board. So yeah, it's really fun. And I've been with the company from the beginning, really focused on marketing. But as you guys know, Austin and Spencer, you kind of manage your own deals and your own companies, and you guys wear a lot of different hats, and who knows what you'll do one day to the next. And it used to very much be that way, but these days I can focus more on just specific marketing tasks and helping our company move along with that.
So then how much outside to inside riding does the Trainer Road guy do?
Yeah. Well, for me personally?
Yeah, you.
I do. Man, I could probably pull the exact percentage, but I would say that I do probably around 85 or 90% of my training outside. And then the rest of it would be inside. Maybe it's closer to 80 just because I live in Reno, Nevada. And in the winter, it's not really nice to train outside. So it's really like, for me, structured training is the priority because I have kids and a demanding job and a lot of other demanding things in my life. So whether I do that inside or outside is kind of irrelevant, but I get a lot of joy from doing my workout outside. Whether it's mountain biking and then being able to descend a fun trail in between my intervals, right? Or yeah, whether it's just being outside and enjoying that. But I also understand that, like a lot of people listen to this, you probably like, if you, indoor training is just such a hack to like get the most out of yourself when you don't have the circumstances that allow it. And a lot of people listen to this with jobs and yeah, all the complexities of life, and man, it really helps. So, but yeah, I do almost all of my training outside.
Damn. I mean, so do I. I mean, yeah. Okay. So then, I feel like Epic is your weapon of choice right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Love that. Much road, just all cross country. Where are we at?
I do a decent amount of road racing. Well, I used to do a ton more, but these days I feel like it's tougher for me to squeeze away and get to races. So I do road racing, love crits. They're tons of fun. It's like the ultimate, like it's like a chess match and with super high stakes, and every move that you make is paid in terms of like energy and pain. And so
like it's pavement, it's this, maybe hitting you as well. Yeah. Maybe that.
Yeah. Hopefully not that sort of pain. But I love crit racing and that sort of thing. But yeah, my primary focus is cross country, and I've raced some enduro. Like I did like the amateur level of like EWS at a race once here at North Star, and that was a blast.
Is that how you met Neil? Or no?
No, I met. So my background is in the moto world, and I raced motocross as a kid growing up, and ski raced, and but moto was like my thing and my obsession growing up.
So you rode Honey Lake?
Oh, all the time. Yeah. Always did the Loretta qualifier, four-stroke nationals back in the day.
That place. I never did good once there. Hell no.
It's so rough, right?
Yeah, and that's why you probably have some fitness, and I had nothing when I went there. I was like, where's the oxygen?
Yeah, high elevation too. But I loved the sport of moto. I miss what it feels like to be good on a dirt bike, and I know that if I got back on it, I wouldn't be good, and I wouldn't have that feeling.
I'm fucking with you on that. Spencer over here, 25-plus guy, though. He's ready to go.
Yeah,
I know. He's still young.
Yeah, Spencer could pick it up tomorrow and qualify for Loretta. So,
so far from that.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah. But I love motocross, and that was like where my roots were. And actually, before Trainer Road, I was it was while I was in college, I was working on this startup that was effectively there's a service these days called Lit Pro in the moto world. And what it does is it tracks what you do on a bike. And prior to Lit Pro coming out, we had the same idea.
Oh, really?
And the concept was that we were going to make the moto world more data driven. And because it's very much the cycling world, I'm very data driven as a person, and the cycling world harbors that. Motocross world does not harbor that at all.
It's getting more there though. I feel now
for sure. No, yeah, especially at the top level. Right. Yeah. But the average person, like, they don't know why they're really slow, and there might be a lot of reasons. But one of the main reasons that they're slow is probably we can just start with line choice and we could really improve that. And so we were trying to get something off the ground.
But it had to be tough. Like this, I mean, here's my thing on that, and not to cut you off too much on it, but like Dungy, shittiest fucking style in the world, multiple championships. So it's so hard to even get people like the Lit Pro is a great idea and your concept sounds like a great idea. But fuck, you would watch Dungy and you'd be like, okay, I guess I fucking just need to prun my elbows down and just throw it all out the door.
Yeah. Certain riders are definitely like more flashy. Like, I mean, you watch Jet Lawrence ride and it's like, it's beautiful. It's genuinely beautiful.
It looks
like
slow. It's fucked up.
I know. It's amazing. Right. But we were getting that off the ground, and I think that, so we were advertising with Steve Mathis's podcast, the Pulp MX show.
Pulp.
And we were fundraising at that point and trying to get things going. So we were advertising for that. And Neil somehow got in touch with me around that time through that. And then Neil and I have been really close friends ever since. And Neil Storrs, we're talking about here, he's a PR pro. And I mean, geez, the motorsports world in general these days. So
good awesome old Neil. Dude.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Neil and Eric. I love those guys.
Yeah, great brothers. So yeah, that's how we got in touch. And that's where my background's at. And that's why I love mountain biking above all, because it's a little closer to moto, but love the road stuff. I've even dabbled, and I know people get upset and turn off the podcast, but I've dabbled in triathlon and stuff too. And try to
have them turn off. Fuck them. You know? Yeah. That's where we're at. You know, I got Spencer on here. Who cares?
That's, you know, right. There we go.
So, I mean, if you were to set out a path for someone to race the Olympics, what would that look like? You're starting 3 years ahead, 2 years. Like, what are these guys? Cause right?
Nobody's
like,
making the Olympics in 3 years, Austin.
I know, but you got to be thinking that way. Like, isn't look at Blevins, right? Like the situation. Like, I feel like he sucked last year.
So maybe
was it because
of
that stuff. Like,
maybe if you pick up an elite rider already that you're trying to help and curate, that's already put in the time. Maybe there's a bit of a chance, but I think it funnels down to so much more than just your training program. Even and. I mean, sorry, I don't mean to disrespect training programs. Obviously, it's a huge, huge, huge part of what you're doing, but there's so much genetic makeup and things that go into being an Olympian, especially in endurance sports. In all sports, realistically. But yeah, I don't think a 3-year plan on a
you would have to though a little bit, right? I mean,
maybe if you're already playing with a guy like Blevins.
That's what I'm trying to say. You're Blevins. You're Christopher Blevins. You're thinking about it. It's like pound yourself into the ground and go race Cape Epic for a little bit and then not race it this year so you have the energy. Is that?
I think it's I think the you have to have a very clear intentional plan for no less than 5 years, in my opinion.
Holy like shit.
Because the thing, like, you know, looking back, a mutual friend of like all of ours here, Keegan Swenson, like he was on the Olympic pathway, right? That Olympic pathway was set out and defined when he was at like USAC development camps and talent ID camps back when he was a kid.
Yeah.
And at that point, it was like, you have this potential and they start to form that idea. And then as a result, you pick your races based off that. You pick everything. You like, it's probably more like a 15-year development plan for a lot of these athletes, for like Riley and those sort of athletes, but very intentional. It has to be, at the very least, it has to be 4 years just because of getting points. The way that it works, and for the people that don't know, it's really complicated. And I don't know it perfectly. So, but I'll just share, I guess, what I do understand.
I feel like it's a very complicated system, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's all based on UCI points. There's the top eight nations get to send two riders per gender to the mountain bike event at the Olympics. From 9th back to the 19th rated countries, they get to send one athlete per gender. The host nation gets to send three. So they get like an extra athlete on either on both for men and women. Now, when you look at that, it's all based on UCI points in terms of their ranking. And while there is typically like a window where it starts and then a window where it closes, you really have to be building up all of that over time. Is that Brian? Oh my goodness.
Yep. We brought BG in.
Oh, that's rad. What's up, man? How are you?
But no, keep going. We're literally talking about point stuff, BG. No pressure. You're just hopping into this one. And we're talking about how you get your Olympic points right now.
Way to go, Austin.
He was ready.
Stoked to have you. This is cool. I love Brian. Brian's a great guy. So you have those top eight nations, right? And for 4 years, you are working to build up a bank of points and to get to the point where you can get call-up positions, to get to the point where you will be in good position to be able to earn points once that window opens. Once that window opens, you have to race as many races that pay as many points as possible. And based on your team's makeup, like for example, in the men's field, you know, the Americans, they are not going to be ranked as highly as the Swiss and the French. So as a result, you're going to look for races where you can actually race well, but then still get a lot of points. Or I should say place well, but get a lot of points. Because the United States, they're ranked sixth right now, if you look at the rankings. So they're going to be going to Greece doing a stage race. They're going to be going to like all these random countries when they should be taking an off season. And they're going to be doing these races because they need to get points. And the really weird and complex part of this whole thing is that you probably need to ask riders that have no chance at making the Olympics to also sacrifice their time, their energy, and their results that they could be having at more immediately important races. They have to sacrifice that to come help you get points, to help you get to the Olympics. And all the while, if you don't make it within the top eight nations, then you only get to send one of you. So in this case, like Chris and Riley, you know, if they're going into these races, they're either allies and working together, or they're kind of enemies, because then they also have to be like, well, you worked so hard to get all these points and now it's benefiting me and you miss out on it. So it's like, it's a really tricky situation, especially if you're somewhere around that eighth position, or you could fall back within that. And if you look at the points, it's like one weekend, you could swing like six positions around there because the point density is really, really close. So even just because of that and the points and the qualification system that you have to follow, I feel like you have to have a minimum of 4 years. But really, I mean, it goes back so far. I mean, to like Spencer said, before they're born, it's like the genetic lottery that needs to happen too for the sort of athlete to get there.
Yeah. All right. That's gnarly. BG, Brian Gordon, specialized. How many team orders have you guys been putting in to get to that?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, it's a long play. So, you know, the team's been working on figuring out what athletes are going to make it there. The Riley versus Chris thing, especially for us because we're American, like that was contentious for a while. But we're still that both of them are young. But yeah, I don't know. There's a lot that's gone into it. You know, like that are the test events, the trial test sessions that we've done. We've built bikes that we don't necessarily sell to like ride and see what's faster on the course just so we fully understand the course. So that was pretty cool. Got some really cool data showing that full suspension bikes are faster even though they're up here. So yeah, lots come into it.
So but like when you're doing that, and I'm guessing other bike brands probably are doing something similar to that, I don't know. Are you, and as a US brand, are you thinking US team, or are you just thinking anyone to get to the Olympics as specialized? How does that work?
we're leading everything. Like, we want our bike to win. We're a global company, so our headquarters, if you still want to call it that, is in California. But, you know, we have innovation centers in Switzerland, Germany, as well as the U.S. and Taiwan. So, see, we're a global company. We have a pretty
but you're secretly focus. Hoping Team USA. Let's just, you know, we're going a little bit with that.
They're our friends, so.
That's right. Good man. Good man. Keep going. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a little bit of a side note, as I was asking BG earlier, is I'm not 100% sure, but is Specialized the most represented bike in the mountain bike side, we think?
I don't know that for sure, but I believe we have six riders.
Six?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm looking at the list right now, and there's a lot of, like, it's very fragmented across brands. The standout is Specialized. Trek has...
three?
Probably a decent amount. You know, we've got Yolanda if she goes, which
she kind of said she wasn't, right?
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I think it's still in the air. I don't know. Maybe I missed that, but she's got some breathing issues that she's been working out. And I know that she mentioned that, like, if she can't do it, then she might forfeit her spot. In which case, maybe Cena would fill in. I don't know. And if Cena goes, that's even one more Specialized bike. No, but, yeah, so Specialized seems to lead. It's going to be the most prevalent one. And I feel like this is probably getting a little further into to where we're making predictions and stuff into this discussion, but I feel like there's a really good opportunity for, like, Victor to win this race. I know Tom Pidcock's, like, the, you know, he seems like the
logical
favorite.
That's Spencer's pick, okay? Pidcock over here.
Yeah, but Victor, honestly, we haven't really seen Victor in form without some sort of negative circumstance and then Tom race each other this year, like, in a heads up scenario. And I feel like Victor in form, especially on home soil, it could be really, like,
the French have done some stucco things on home soil.
Totally.
That and in motocross, but yeah.
And in all cycling, all forms of cycling, I would say.
You're right. I mean, not to put you on the spot a little bit, BG, but, like, what's been going on here, you know? Like, you kind of know the guy, you know, so we're just going to get a little insight on him. But, like, is he backing it down on some of these World Cups to save it for that right now? Or is some other stuff going on? What's up?
I think that's the logical assumption, right? Like, Kane Rossell needs to carry a spot. The French pool of talent is super deep. So it wasn't, like, a free ride for him. Like, he has Saru, a few others to battle with. So he made a showing at the first two World Cups, and I think Jody was strongest and there was no debate there. And then he was locked in, and now, like, kind of what's the point? Like, it's the biggest race of his career, potentially. Olympics in his own country. Like, I think that's his big goal. So for him to go and, like, perform at all these World Cups and potentially burn himself out, I don't think it makes as much sense. So yeah, we'll see. I'm really curious to see about both him and Pidcock, both in top shape and fully gunning for the win.
Are we going to keep the chain on the bike this time? Like, what's up? Pressure. No pressure.
We will do what we can to keep the chain.
Sorry, I had to ask.
We made him custom chain guys so he could run a large chain.
Up. Really? What size does he run?
That's his top secret information.
Oh, fuck. All right. Sorry. I know. I'm sure everyone's listening to this who is racing the Olympics, they're going to get that info, and we just fucked them. But I mean, I'm a 34 guy and it's fucking rough. So if he's any bigger than that, like, fuck, dude.
I mean, he had a 40 on his bike in Nova Mesta. So
is this custom made? Like, holy shit. Do they make that?
Manual states 36 is max capacity. 38 fits very close. I run a 38 for most of my training because I do a lot of my training on, like, not steep stuff and I want higher speed.
Wow, that's pretty sick. I run a 32.
I'm bigger than Spencer. That matters to me right now.
I've heard about the 40, though, and I don't know if people space it out or get the chain ring custom made or anything else, but I know the 40s exist. I've seen them and handled them.
When he ran into them, that's what they did, spaced over a bit. So his cranks were slightly offset. I'm not sure what they did to compensate with, like, pedal washers or Kuya Destin or something like that, but it was also for a short track race, so you just deal with it for track. I don't think he ran a 40 in the head seat, so
what is this guy like on an e-bike?
It's probably going faster than you go on an e-bike.
Well, that's apparent. Everyone in this room is faster than me on an e-bike, okay? I couldn't even when you guys on an analog, I'm fucked, you know? Like, there's no chance here. So, look, I mean, is everyone else running 40s? Like, I mean, and not saying on your team, but just everyone? Are they, is this where everyone's at? Like, what the fuck are we doing here?
It depends on the nature of the course.
Right, Brian?
Yeah. Well, yeah, chain line, you can stay... You can stay out of the, if you're GLB and you want to be in the small car because there's more crack there. So there's that topic. And then just finity on any trip, of course. Like, you don't want to spin out in a sprint and lose it over that. If you don't need the climbing gears, then better to err on that side, I think.
And to be clear, I don't run a 38 in most races, right? Like,
you, but you I'm own not, one. It's in I'm the garage.
Yeah, no, it's on the bike right now. But yeah, I'm not fast enough to run a 38 on most courses, but it is really interesting. Like, if you use the SRAM app and you look at your drivetrain and the time spent in your different cogs, granted there's like barriers. There's like, if it's like a range, you know, you have like on one side, you have your 10, on the other side, you have your 52. And if you're getting ground down to like 40 RPM, you need to change your chainring size, right? Like, so there are those sort of limits to consider, but when you look at the time you spend, ideally, you're spending the most time where your chain line is most straight instead of way up high on that chain ring or way down low.
Yeah,
it actually does like add quite a lot of drag to the system. So for these sort of guys like Victor and those sort of that are really like splitting hairs, you know, that's why you'll see some. I mean, they, number one, they have the power to be able to pull it off. But that's why sometimes they make those decisions, is because they're like, well, on this course, I'm going to be spending, you know, 85% of my time within the center of that cassette if I use this chain ring. But if I don't use that chain ring, I'm going to be pushed further up the cassette or further down the cassette, and that's going to cause more drag, you know.
Wow.
So yeah.
So now, from a training perspective, not to change the subject here, what are your thoughts on we were just talking about Victor maybe coming out swinging, doing a full blast beginning part of the season and then stepping it back to in preparations for the Olympics? And then you have somebody like Tom Pidcock who's doing the exact opposite. You go from racing a World Cup now to racing Tour de France up until the Olympics, basically. And I don't know exactly what he's doing, but 5-hour days on the bike consecutively, or 3 hours, however long the stage is, isn't exactly my idea of perfect cross-country training, especially if he's coming to, I mean, I know Tom Pidcock's Tom Pidcock and it's probably going to work out, but those are two very, very, very different approaches to Olympic training.
Yeah. It's interesting because kind of earlier what we were talking about too, there's nothing special that like an Olympic athlete does to train for the Olympics. They might do some course specific adjustments to their interval training where it's like, for this course, if it's going to be, and this course is a bit more like punchy and not like steady rhythm, steady climbing. So as a result, they're probably going to be focusing on repeated efforts rather than something a bit more sustained. But really, it's not like there's no Olympic workout, really. You know, like, these athletes are just going to be focusing on VO2 max and anaerobic capabilities and the ability to repeat them. And that's going to be more their focus now, whereas in the months and months prior, they were really focusing on building up their aerobic base to be able to support that sort of training. But the interesting thing for sure is that, like, an athlete like Chris, Haley, all these other athletes that and Sevilla that have been fighting to get points to qualify, they had to peak around Brazil to a certain extent. It may have not been the highest peak they've reached. Maybe it was. I don't know. But they did have to peak, and then they have to reset and rebuild to go back in. And So that's why we're seeing, like, right now, Chris not having as good of results. That's why we're seeing Haley and Sevilla not having as good of results. Although Sevilla's have been like really impressively consistent amidst her turndown. It's been very impressive to see. Riley has still been up at the peak. And the question is, can Riley just keep riding this wave? I don't know. Like, it's going to be crazy to see. He's, you know,
BG over there with a smile.
Yeah, the hard thing. I mean, a peak is inherently has a steep side on both sides to it. Like, you can't just, otherwise it would be a plateau, right? You can't maintain that high level of performance like that. So going back to Pidcock, you know, we have Victor and we have all these other guys that are probably turning down, and they have been turned down, and they're ramping back up because they have the race on July 29th. So they're a little under a month away now.
Yep.
And compared to Tom, I have no clue. Tom's in a totally different world where his team is probably much more focused on the Tour de France. And he is what it sounds like, one of the multiple GC hopes. So with how his tour has been going so far, it's not likely that he's going to be in podium contention or anything. So I'm curious to see what they do now. But Tom also is like a very unique athlete. Like we have like three, or really like four very special road cyclists on the men's side right now. Vanderpool, Van Aert, we have Pogacar, and then we also have, it's Tom Pidcock. And I know Vingegaard's awesome, but they don't have these, like, especially those three of Vanderpool and Pidcock. They can do every sport or every discipline of cycling so well. So he's such a special talent that he might be able to show up to the XCO race fatigued, boxed, buckled, and still like be able to win. I don't know. It's going to be really kind of like an interesting case study to see how he does that, especially considering the fact that he then has the road race. Two or three days later.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's XCO is pretty short, right? In the sense that they're talking, it's going to be an hour to 90 minutes.
Short enough.
yeah. It's,
I wonder it might if be like they pulls on. I wonder if they pulls on out of this work.
That's what I was just going to ask. If he goes really far back, yeah, I bet you they do. I mean,
Well, for them, it's probably less about like winning the mountain bike gold, and they probably really want him to win the road gold. Like, you know, I don't know. I guess maybe that is important to the team, but road seems like it would be very important to them. I would not be surprised. I don't know if Vanderpool's undercooked coming in to like warm up throughout the tour.
Vanderpool even on a team yet? Have they announced what?
Well, he's on his team, but he's not doing the mountain bike race.
Oh, he's not doing the mountain bike. Okay. Yeah. I'm looking at the teams now that have been announced, and he's nowhere to be seen. And
he's not doing it. But I wonder, to your point, Brian, if like he gets pulled, like if there is going to be pulling because of the Olympic road race, like within the tour because of this, whether it's road race, mountain bike.
It seems like Tom might have it in his best, in his own interest to win the road race because he's already won the mountain race. Maybe.
Yeah.
That'd be hard to say. It is unique though. Like, you know, between after that World Cup races, we kind of see like what our riders are doing and how they're preparing like weekend to weekend. And it's mostly like recovery, like short efforts, maybe like a 3-hour ride, something like that generally. And Tom's like riding from venue to venue, just like 5.5 hours of the bike. So, and then like wins both weekends too. It's not like he's doing that and he's fried.
Yeah. And I don't want to like, I don't know what they're running, and I know that Ineos puts a bunch of money into equipment and that sort of thing. But I can't help but feel like Tom might be at adding to this Tom is amazing thing. Tom might also be at an equipment disadvantage, relatively speaking. I don't know. I mean, Pinarello's new to this game, right? Yeah. They don't have decades and like you know, we have Brian here who's one of the head people in deciding the direction of the Epic platform and where it goes and managing that. It's a platform that you've built upon for years to like get refined equipment. Whereas Pinarello's new to this. So the guy's just incredible. Like Spencer can't be faulted. You can't be faulted at all for picking him. He's the outright favorite for sure. You know?
So like, I guess for that, like maybe not to put it too much on the spot, would you do better on a specialized something that has? There we go. That's the answer. There we go. All right. So, but
he
like,
has win world champs on it. He won his, I think, first mountain bike world champs on a specialized bike.
Oof. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, okay. I did look better back.
But then he won the wall run of Pinarello. So I can say it was just the bike.
We can. So, I mean, like, as a team, like, I mean, as for specialized, and when you obviously know that there's like these guys like a Pidcock or Vanderpool out there, how do you guys go about selecting a team and building your riders at like, you have to start at a pretty young age. Like you guys have had Blevins there forever. Does that go into the mindset of, you know, like those are once in a 10 years century type thing, Pidcocks, right? Like how do you find that? Or what do you guys do as a team for something like that?
That's difficult. Like Christopher, we saw as a young talent and brought him in and we saw like the potential. He had all the things that he needed to be one of the world's best. And we believed in him and brought him in early and he, you know, from Durango, like we had Ned on the ground there at the time, like Todd and Howard and all of them. So there was a pretty deep connection. And then Yeah, just build it on it. We believe in it, and he stayed with us, which is really cool. We had some riders come and go, and that's not always as fun, but it's really cool that we have the longevity with Christopher. And then we don't have that with more riders. Like, you know, Haley is another one. Laura Stigger is another one. It's like right out of junior, we rock her on. I think she was definitely still U23, now racing the lead. We see a lot of potential in her, and those are riders that we obviously identified early on and brought in. Other riders like Victor, you know, he's been with us for 2 years. We obviously saw the talent there. And we believe he could be earlier brought him onto our team, and now with Olympic Stage in France, that's going to be really exciting. So,
as a brand's perspective, are you guys, is that why we see, like, because like Blevins is kind of a guy who does good with great suspension and handling. Is this is why, are you guys developing bikes around these guys for multiple years to building the best tailored for them, you know, like so they can perform better? Or is it just like, no, this is what the data shows, we need to go this way? Or like, how does that work out?
There's a big component that comes from the team. Like, we're watching the way racing's evolving and the way the riders are evolving. They're riding so much differently than they were a decade ago.
Yeah.
And even talking to like Souser, who, you know, he came out through the sport. He was one of the greatest of all time. And then he's coaching riders like Sam Gaze and Simon and watching them. And he's like, I go into like a corner with these guys and they come out going twice as fast as me. Like, I don't understand how they can like ride berms and jumps and like rollers and that kind of stuff as fast. Where Susie back in the day, it's all that like old school technical backcountry riding. And that's like what he was good at and what brought him through the sport. He's like a totally different sport almost now, like with the shorter formats. And so riders like, you know, Christopher, Bradley, Bjorn, Martin is insane from our Chilean rider on the team. Watching those guys ride is like mind blowing how good they are technically. And just the way that they're pushing the bikes pushes us to make a bike that can handle that. And then as the forces evolve too, that all kind of translates into, you know, the bike we just launched this year, the Epic 8. So
yeah, it's something we were kind of, Austin and I were kind of talking about before you guys came on. The rider, especially the cross-country rider, has been pushed to evolve so much. And especially the United States, American riders. I mean, when I started racing cross-country, I mean, you would be pretty strapped to try to find a super technical cross-country course in the United States. And it was kind of breeding these roadie-esque riders. And I mean, obviously Blevins is a proponent that's come from the U.S. scene, but they're, most of the people growing up that I grew up with racing were not as technically savvy, and it's kind of cool to see the courses are evolving, and now all these other riders are especially at the World Cup level are extremely talented bike riders. They're not just the strongest guys ever there, or girls, whatever. Yeah. They're also out here being extremely proficient on their bike, which is super cool.
I feel like it's been a co-development, right? Like as bikes, because courses, honestly, if for us in the United States, they're getting more technical. For a while, I feel like it was pretty sanitized, and it seems like they're getting a bit more technical, but then again, I haven't raced a Pro XCT in like 18 months or something. So it's been a while, or US Cup or whatever. But I would say that the bikes have gotten more capable and still efficient, which is the crazy thing. Like, we've been able to have our cake and eat it too. And then on top of that, it's been met with like riders that have amazing skills. And it's really like kind of, that's, I feel like it's accelerating, and for kind of the coursers are actually having to try to keep up now with that. And it's because it's really changed the game entirely. Go back to 2016 when we were riding on bikes with 100 mils of travel, and really like the narrative was like, you know, stiff is fast, and that was where everything kind of, that was where we were coming from. And that transitional period around then, it was really starting to shift toward like compliance, control, traction, like having a bike that's behaving well underneath you. And it's just completely changed the game. I mean, the stuff that we can ride on our, like the stuff, well, I mean, the stuff that Spencer rides is absurd because it's Spencer, but like the stuff that we can ride on our cross country bikes is crazy now. We used to never be able to do it.
Yeah. John, you know, I met you, Jonathan. We were warming up on hard sales, I think, up in William Park, and yeah, there was like a couple rocks on that course. And other than that, it was just like, go up the steepest part of the hill you can and whoever gets to the finish first wins.
Yes.
And, yeah. You know, Tommy Lattai, who runs the US Cup stuff, when they were building out the Fayetteville courses down in Arkansas, it was like, we need a real cross-country course because we're developing all these juniors through programs like Gear Development or whatever, and great, and they have a ton of fitness, but then we send them over to Europe, and they're just burned out off the back, can't ride in the roots, like, they don't know how to handle their bikes, and so we need to, like, build the courses to that level in the USA so that we can build the talent for the USA team to go and then compete at the World Cups. And a select few have done it. You know, like Kaylee Dang grew up in Park City. They have technical trails there, spends a lot of time in British Columbia. They have plenty of technical trails there. And she's riding in like on Renegades. And so her skills are insane. But just like the generation, you know, growing up in like Southern California and places like that where the trails maybe aren't lending to the same technicality that you'd find in the Pacific Northwest. We need to let those riders on courses where they can develop those skills. Yeah. I'll have to go to NICA too, which needs to be approachable and beginner friendly, of course, but a rider going through that program is not going to develop skills they need to race Trans Montana in the U23. Like,
not
hey,
at all.
Hey, it is true.
Not at all, though. You're totally right, because I think I've said this on a few of these things, but when I was first starting the NICA League, there was a rule where both wheels had to stay on the ground at all time. Like, you could not jump. You couldn't hit some jumps in the back section of Vail Lake because it's dangerous. And I got reprimanded from doing that before, and like,
I bet
that
you
just,
did.
I mean, that just wasn't.
I can't see Spencer abiding by those rules at all. Yeah,
that's just not the right way to develop skills.
Sounds like a lawsuit.
It was all. I mean, I'm sure that those things like that came into play at some point, but you need to still develop riders and push them and allow them to push themselves through a little more technical terrain and have some fun.
I think developing the skills is important. Like, you can say like hitting the jump is dangerous, but not having those skills and then going to a race where you need to have those skills to complete it, like that's when you're going to crash.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting at one of the drops in Fayetteville for the junior elite race, which was like pretty high level riders. And there's riders
they
that
were going
like,
around.
They were not going around.
Well, they were dying off
they
it
were
as well.
They were actually rolling the features because if they went around, it was way too slow. So they're like, I have to do it. But then like watching them do it, they were so uncomfortable. And it's like, when your heart rate's pinned, you probably don't want
it made for great TV. I'm sorry, but
Yes, you had the first row seat there.
Yes, but that's great.
But yeah, like that, those are the things where it's like, if they went off a truck here and there, like they would have those skills and they could build up and progress rather than just being like thrown into the fire when they go to a race.
So in Europe, are they developing that better, I guess, like at their junior races?
I've only been to a few, but they're incredibly technical. I could not ride the whole course.
What?
Yes.
Why?
Like, because it rains and it's slick and you can't, like, there's technical climb, but you're just like, I can't, I'm going to walk. And same thing for the descents. You're like 1 foot off. It's like, it's not like big drops and jumps or anything, but it's just like weird off camber routes where you just need to have like the balance and that like fine technical skill to get through it smoothly. So that's where, I saw the pro race go through on first lap and like half the riders dismount and run up the climb because the probability of making it up in the pack was low. But that's the stuff that they're racing on.
Wow.
How they train as kids too. Like, you'll see like a bunch of videos online of like tiny little kids riding these bikes on these little like skills courses. Like, where they're having to balance and like ride through these like cones and on a skinny and pick up something and move it over here without like dabbing a foot. They do all these like, and it's definitely like very popular in Switzerland, I know, in particular, where they have like the bike culture is very much strong there on mountain biking. And they start these kids off with learning those technical sort of skills. I'm not saying that riding a tiny skinny in a parking lot suddenly makes you like a really
capable
rider.
That's what I heard. I heard that.
But
why Crans Montana was just that gnarly?
Yeah. I think that honestly, that's those sort of skills need to be in like the foundation, and to what Spencer and Brian have been saying, like, you know, if you grew up racing on courses that are just buff the whole way through, then you do miss out on that. It's kind of funny. Like the Olympic courses are never, they're always a weird amalgamation of this. And Brian, you might have more insight. I don't know if you've even been there, perhaps, but it like Olympic courses don't look raw and natural. They're not. They look very much handmade, right?
Yeah, very manmade. Like the course in Paris, from the videos I've seen, and I've not been there. Our team has been there, so I've seen like the real early preview videos that went out before the test event last year, and just took like iPhone clips and rode around the course. And he's like, maybe we race gravel bikes here. No way. Obviously, the course has been ridden in, and there are some quite technical features on the course. It's really like wide for the most part, gravel. So imagine like a gravel walking path through park. But then you have like gnarly like rock sections or like a drop with like super sketchy lines through it or little gap jumps and stuff. So it's smooth with like, I would say, relatively technical features. I know some riders were actually injured when they had the last test session. So it's acceptable, but in between the technical sections, it's very buffed out.
Yeah. So I was lucky enough a handful of years ago, about 2 months before the Rio Olympics, to go down and do a multi-sport race. And I rode a test event on the Rio Olympic course. And it's very much that. In between, exactly to what Brian said, in between the technical bits, it was like a golf course pathway. Like, it's perfect, pristine little gravel trail. And then you get off or you keep going, and now there's this boulder field that there's only two or three options to get through this. And it's extremely technical and extremely gnarly. But then once you get through it, you're back to your smooth path. And then they put logs in, and it was super, super challenging because it just feels so unnatural, and there's no natural flow that you have. It kind of looks like that's how most of the Olympic courses are built. Whereas the current World Cup trails have a little more natural flow put into them. So we'll see. I haven't seen too much in this Paris course, but it's a different.
I've got some data on the course.
Okay.
With this, like, and you can go and check out, like, I'll share some links with you to Austin, so you can put them down in the description for people. But yeah. Annika Bjerten, she went and rode the course with Haley Batten. And there's a video online, like a first person view. The course may change in terms of what we'll see from what they had. And it was, like Brian said, it was very fresh. So perhaps it's more ridden in since now. To give you guys like some background on the course, it's 2.5 miles long or 4.1 Ks. And you climb 249 feet or 75 meters. That probably doesn't mean a whole lot to people if they aren't used to like XCO courses, but to put it in comparison, it's got 38% more climbing than snowshoe per lap. Cool. That snowshoe West Virginia course, but it's also got 45% less climbing per lap than Crans Montana. So that's like climb per distance, if you will. So for every like linear foot along the course, how much is climbed? So it's not like, and the interesting thing is when you look at the elevation profile, and I'll share like a Strava link to the route that I made up of it. So you can see when you look at the elevation profile, it's, and even watch the video, it's not consistent. It looks like it would actually be very tough to find a rhythm on this course and like settle into a groove or a flow. It's just constantly kind of like what Spencer said. It's like, oh, here's another man-made feature. Here's another man-made feature. But then also the topography and the way that they use it, it's oddly short, steep little punch into something that's like a bit more gradual, but it's always fluctuating. It's just constantly moving. At the very end of the course, they kind of go off into some natural soil with a bit of roots. And then they cut back into the manicured paths thereafter. But is this a purpose thing?
Like, are they doing this on purpose, you think?
A lot of people have assumed, and I'd be curious if Brian and Spencer, you have more insight, but I've heard people assuming the fact that it's for like, aesthetics. It makes for like a beautiful looking venue. This is the Olympics. You have a lot of people that don't understand the sport. And if their view is being obstructed by a bunch of trees and you can't really tell where the trail is going and it isn't going, that might not be as appealing to them. But I'm not sure if that's that makes a lot of logical sense, right? But
logic help isn't with TV. Always, I like where you're going with this.
Logic isn't always the reasoning, you know?
Yeah. I mean, do you know anything, BG, or?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. That's my understanding as well. They're also working with a location that needs to be a certain distance from wherever like the center of the Olympics is going to be. So I think that limits it a bit to where they can have a race.
But Benelli is what I heard for 2028. Like, pretty much confirmed. What do you guys think that's going to look like? I mean, it almost could work pretty well, but are they going to just rebuild everything there, right?
I think they'll have to build a track up in LA. Maybe they can reuse some of what the old course was, but it seems to me they would have to pretty much build everything. But I think that's a great venue it's for honestly, it. Like, it's beautiful. Yeah. There's a lake. Like, it totally makes sense for TV.
It's right in the landing site for the airport, so it's really fun to get approval for drone there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But Austin, hit me up, problems. UCI. I'll do the stream for you. Don't worry. Yeah, so I mean, and then I would kind of want to go back to like talking about the suspension thing. I feel like a few years ago, 120 would have been fucking nuts on an XC bike, and they are just literally racing on that. And then your guys' specializes hardtail is not a hardtail in a sense, right? Like, it's fucking wild. Like, is it the speed, the courses that made you guys go this way, or just the technology? Is it a combo of both?
Yeah. Sorry about backwards.
No, you're good.
So with hardtails, it was interesting. Like, Haley and Christopher historically have been like major hardtail fans. They love that snappy accelerating feel they get. They love how light they are. They love how they climb. Our goal with Epic World Cup, which is our short travel, you know, 75-mile rear travel kind of hardtail replacement bike, was really to like build a bike that could replace a hardtail in terms of the pedaling response and snappiness, but not let the rider down when they got into technical terrain. And so we prioritize that bike with zero sag. It rides really high up. It has like full-on hardtail pedaling response, but when you get into rough sections, you can carry momentum. The wheel starts to move. It has kind of this like blow-off feeling, and it's just really cool. It's also a bit lighter than the Epic 8, which is our 120 platform. With the Epic 8, we saw with our previous generation Epic platform, a lot of riders gravitating towards the Evo because of the capability and how light it was. When you put a lockout on it, that was great. So we kind of were like, okay, what would we do to this bike to make it ready for a World Cup race or a race like the Cape Epic or something where efficiency is still a major priority? And so we kind of rethought the kinematics there, the shock tuning, things like that. Obviously focused a lot on the frame layout, making sure that there was great stiffness there and it was super light. And then, so now we have these two great race platforms, which I'm really excited, like as a product manager of both of those bikes, to see both of them represented at the Olympics. So we will have some riders on Epic World Cup, some riders on Epic 8. And it really just depends on what the rider is looking for, like how it suits their riding style, and then where they think they can, you know, focus on different parts of the course and make up time. Of course, the Epic 8 is going to be a little bit more on like the capability side. You know, Sai was in evenly, along with Alan, so riding through those like boulder fields and drops and things like that are going to feel really nice. Whereas the Epic World Cup, since it holds you up high in the rear, and it's more or less like an automated suspension that's extremely immediate, like whereas flight attendant takes a minute to get you back to lockout, the Epic World Cup will return you to an efficient pedaling position immediately. So as Jonathan was saying, like the course is super punchy. You're constantly going to be in and out of the saddle, up and down, like down like a drop, and then immediately sprinting up a hill. And so there's no delay. The rider will be in like the most efficient position and ready to attack the time immediately. And that's sort of that Epic World Cup can yield a benefit for the rider.
What's the consensus then? What are we seeing?
We're seeing a pretty even split. Equal hot three riders on Epic World Cup and three on the Epic 8.
So that is Pickock on a hardtail?
TBD. So a lot of riders were testing hardtails. We no longer make the top level hardtail, but we did build some older ones to test them and collect data, because we wanted to know for sure what the fastest bike was. And a few riders, and particularly Haley and Laura, were interested to know. And, you know, they're looking at what everyone else is riding, of course, and like, okay, we believe the Epic World Cup can be the fastest, but we want to know for sure that it is the fastest. So they wanted to do back-to-back testing. We built them bikes, identical, just different frames, and we collected a bunch of information, and we were able to make the decision all of that was the fastest. So,
and that decision was the World Cup is the fastest, correct?
So, yeah, we will not be racing our tail at Epic Paris, to my knowledge, as of today.
Unless you have one you're building right now. I know we only got like 4 or 5 minutes with you, but so is it legal to just build a bike that doesn't race anywhere else or and not even being sold to race at the Olympics?
Technically it is being sold. So we still do sell the Epic Hardtail and Comp model for a price point proposition. So we can't bring an Epic World Cup down to that like sub 3,000 price point for riders. So it is a bike we sell on market. It's not a bike that the race team uses, but we did get a few of them. It's still an incredibly light frame. It's like just over 900 grams. So comparing that to an Epic World Cup, that's still like a 800 gram weight savings. So it's worthwhile to test because if that can save you a little time on the climbs, then it's worth it. And I think what we found was it was like 2 to 3 seconds or something faster over all the climbs to be on the Hardtail. But when you factor that in with all the downhills and the drops and the recovery and all that, we believe that there's much more time than 3 seconds over the race.
It sounds painful to ride a Hardtail.
When you see the roughness of the technical sections, and as Jonathan mentioned, the little section in the woods where it's like off camber roots and it's pretty rough, like pedaling a Hardtail through that does not sound fun. The cool thing from my very biased perspective is that we have great full suspension bikes to offer our riders that are incredibly light. If a rider is coming from a brand where their full suspension option is 25, 26 pounds, a Hardtail makes a lot of sense. Yeah. But when we have a full suspension bike that can be sub 22, like a competitor's Hardtail is, you know, only a pound or maybe 2 pounds lighter. And so they're not really getting that same advantage with weight because we have such a good full suspension bike.
Is there anything inside the swap box when they're racing?
No. If you look closely, there's not even a lever on that box. It's a bolt-on. Very easy solution.
So no tube, nothing?
No, they don't need that. They've got sex zones.
That had to be a weird decision for you guys to, because it's the same front triangle, right?
Why would it be a weird decision?
No, I don't know.
They're not in.
That added some weight, right? To have that hole or?
Yeah, so the reason we decided to put a swap on the bike was because we had that it worked out for the very like weight-focused, efficiency-minded riders that are racing shorter format racing. We also, on the other side of the spectrum, we have racers going to VC bike race and doing these marathon races, Whiskey 50s, with set pick, whatever it is, and having some storage is nice. So, and then beyond that, like we knew going into this project that we would make Evo builds for Spencer to do 360s on and stuff and trail ride on. And so having storage on like a little bit more trail oriented bike for just like long backcountry rides was really important.
And so, if anyone needs a swap box, it's fucking Spencer.
I'll have you know that 90% of the time there's nothing in mine.
I know. He's always getting fucked up shit out there and he's like, I ain't got nothing in here. And I'm like, bro, let me just pull the camera bag off.
I'd say you guys did a really good job on the newest version of the SWAT door, the one that's on the Epic, and I guess now the new Stump Jumper that just came out too. It's got to be the most like simple door I've seen. Like across different brands and stuff, it's easy to get a lot of bulk because you're trying to create like a strong door that can have a bottle cage on there, and heaven knows we all like reef on our bottle cages a little too much in different angles. You have to account for all that, but this has to be like the most minimally designed, like it's very elegant, I guess I would say. Like there, so it, yeah. I don't think there's probably not a big weight penalty there.
It's not massive. There is weight there. Like I mean, for instance, the frame is structurally perfect to ride without the door, and the door weighs just under 70 grams. So at bare minimum, it's a 70 gram weight add to the bike, but it's still an incredibly light bike, and it makes it so much more versatile. I mean, not that the trade off was worth it. If you ask for a World Cup team, they will disagree wholeheartedly because they're
fully focused on. Well, that's what I mean. Then, like, that's gnarly.
But they do say they love it for training. But if it could be lighter, I would say don't do it because when they're on race day, like, they, of course, want to have the lightest thing possible. That's to Jonathan's point. Like, this new slot system that we've developed is incredibly sleek and much lighter and a much simpler construction in the frame and everything. So that was why we thought that it could work on an Epic. I think the previous version, it was a little bit too bulky, even just like the visual weight of like having it there. It was just kind of like too in your face. The interface to use it wasn't as convenient. So this was kind of like, but you know, if this SWAT system doesn't make it to production, we don't want SWAT on the Epic. but if we can do this, then like we totally do want him on the Epic. And that was like a decision we made in development.
I think there's a key point to make too, that all of us overestimate the impact of weight in terms of like affecting our times, and we underestimate the impact of like the positive impact of compliance and like the other things that don't seem to necessarily make you faster. Like all of us obsess over it way too much. I always run these like simulations all the time for different athletes, like focusing on different races or goals. And
you're tearing my dreams down right now. Just to let you know, I need the carbon bars, make carbon everything on my bike.
To why we should have carbon stuff. It's different though. It's not just weight, but like and Brian's better to speak on that, but like, when you look at the difference between a pound of weight and what that pound makes on something like a cross country course, and you were talking like the person can't feel any difference. In theory, you're just adding a pound or removing a pound. It's operating in a vacuum, right? And I guess I'll use like Alpe d'Huez as an example, like that famous climb in the Tour that everyone hears about. You know, the fastest times are somewhere around 50 minutes that somebody's going to do. For somebody like me, it's probably going to be like an hour, 15 minutes. I don't know. But if I'm going up up Alpe d'Huez, it's going to cost me, having 1 pound extra is going to cost me 4.5 seconds. That's based on what Best Bike Split says. So like, I know that we always think it makes a huge difference, but I think that in practical tests, and I'd be really curious, I bet like Brian said, his athletes like the feeling, and that like Epic World Cup, when you get out of the saddle on it and you sprint, it's a hardtail. Like you can't feel any difference on it. It's really snappy. And I almost wonder if that psychological difference makes us feel faster.
Sure, I think.
And then, you know, like it certainly convinces us, but even makes us maybe ride faster in a few ways. But just in terms of weight and its impact, it has less of a detrimental effect on our times than we think. But the reason I think that we have like carbon and all that stuff is because you can tune the feel of everything so particularly. And that's why, like, I think, if you get like a set of carbon bars that's just super light and you're going to some like Euro brand that's like really fringe and you're buying some super light bars, your bike's probably going to ride worse. Like it's not going to feel as good. Whereas if you went for something where it's a brand that's really put engineering into like making sure that everything is refined to ride well, carbon gives you an advantage there, like that you can change the way everything is laid up so it really performs well. So I still think carbon's the best, but not for weight. I think it just rides better and performs better.
Oh, I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think the mind is an insanely powerful part of the puzzle of all of this stuff. And just like throwing a full face helmet on versus a half shell helmet on, you have that sense of confidence and safety, added safety, albeit some added safety. But when you're descending a downhill trail with a full face helmet versus a half shell, you are that much more confident in what you have. And I think it's a similar thing when you know that your bike is 50 grams lighter than the dudes next to you, even though it's only going to save you half a second at the end of the day or whatever it is in a cross country race. You know that you have the lightest bike possible, so you are that much more confident in what's going to come out of it. So yeah, it's super interesting because you're probably 100% right. I think those guys, the Specialized team, doesn't want SWAT because of that 90 grams or whatever you said, but in all actuality, it's not making hardly any difference, but they're confident that their bike is lighter than it would be with it or without.
Yeah, I think they're aware of it. Like Ailey even said to me, like she doesn't really want to race the hardtail, but she wants to like look next to her and see Ollie on hardtail and know that she's on a faster bike.
Yeah.
And that's
sure.
It's mental. That's all it needs.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
oh yeah,
BG, I know you have to go 4:30 late. Are we pulling you too long here? Call it. I mean, look, the only reason I ride S-Works is for the carbon. I mean, it's like the best. So let's just be real with that. But I personally feel like it rides better. I don't know if I'm like,
what are you talking about? Like, S-Works versus a expert build?
Yes. Yes. Is that weird?
It might be somewhat.
Oh, it's mental as fuck.
No,
that I
no, there are So with the other platform, we do have unique layups and unique materials used in S-Works versus the 11M frames that we use on Pro Expert Comp. However, the stiffness numbers are identical. So when we're changing layup, the benefit you're getting on S-Works is we call it the lower FAW carbon, and basically it's a lighter weight, has a better stiffness weight ratio, so we can use less material and get the same stiffness targets. But our rider first engineering story holds true down the line. So if you get an S-Works bike and it has certain stiffness characteristics through cornering or vibration damping, things like that, you'll have very similar experience on a lower tier bike, chassis, that is. Obviously, components make a big difference as well. If you're going from like aluminum wheels to carbon wheels, that's a big factor. So,
can we put Spencer on a slower bike so I have more of a chance if I ride the S-Works? Like, where do we get to these levels? Bike. I need a...
Yeah, you put him on the Levo and you turn it off. And then
you ride your F-ish. I fucking like where you're going with this. Yes, sell me more on that. So... Yeah, sorry, but
you can go. You can go, BG.
You can give him any more ideas. I mean, I'm just gonna. Oh, I mean, dude, yeah. Like, I need a special bike to drag Spencer down and give me a little extra, like a kill switch button. Any of these things.
I will get on the development of that. I'd like that slows Spencer down. We get around you.
I'm not even that fast.
Oh, I need every ounce of ammo. I mean, this. Yeah, I just won't even say it. It's probably because he just actually builds the trails that we only ride for some reason. He never wants to come to my side of town, ride my trails that I have the local knowledge and just shred on. That's what it is. That's what it is. Yeah. Yeah. He's lucky I didn't race Sea Otter. I was coming for him.
All right. Next subject. Jeez.
No, go ahead. Go. Get out of here. Hey, go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah.
Good to see you, Brian.
Thanks, BG. I have like, 10 minutes. You guys all good? Cool. 10 more minutes, yeah. Something like that. Yeah,
absolutely.
All right.
I'm
so
to short track.
Yeah. All right. Guesses right now. Predictions. You have Pitcock, Spencer. Where are you guys at? What are we thinking for winning the Olympics men's category?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. We'll see how it shapes up, but I just admire Tom Pitcock and his versatility and everything that he has going on. And I just, yeah, watching the last couple World Cups, that he participated in, I just would be hard to bet against them, especially if they pull him from the tour. Even if his priorities road, no, I don't think there's a bone in that guy's body that'll sit up in an XC race if he's in a position where he can win. So yeah, I think, I would love for the Americans to do really well and play strongly, and if we can pull off a win, that would be incredible. But for now, my selection is Mr. Tom Pitcock.
Jonathan, your pick. Be going with
Pitcock, Koretsky, Schurter is my podium.
Oh wow, you got the top three on you. Hit me hard right there.
Yeah, that's right. But I would love. That's like what my brain says, but what my heart says is, of course, Nino. Like, that would be like amazing to see him win, and then also to see Koretsky win. But that's what I think will happen. Pitcock, Koretsky, sure.
Yeah,
yeah.
Never count Nino out.
No, he's probably like in this situation where he's like, I don't know. Do you think I can? And I bet he's like excited at the chance that he could. That's the difference, right? Like, he has like. He's just so incredible.
And people are starting to count him out too, which I think is probably fuels his fire even more.
Has Nino ever won an Olympics? No.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, shit. Yeah. Sorry.
A couple of them.
Okay. I suck. Sorry. Knowledge. A couple of them.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think he's, I think he's two times.
He definitely, I'm
two times.
Sure. Let me see.
I guess we should look that up. Yeah. Women's top three then. Where you guys at on that, Jonathan?
Pauline Ferrand Prevot first, Puck Peterse second, and Haley Batten third is what I'm thinking. Pauline just seems like she's on a different level right now.
That's crazy, right? And she said that she's done after this year, right? She's like, I've accomplished everything I wanted to.
She's going to back to road with Visma Lisa bike. She's going to go to that team and just focus on road. So
really? Yeah. I thought some reason I thought I heard cross. I don't know why I thought I heard that.
She might do cross too. Yeah, she might. Wow. I don't know. We'll see. But yeah, she's going to Visma and then wants to really focus on road. I think, you know, women's road racing has grown a ton, like over the past 4 years. And she was already, I think, road world champ, but that was prior to when it really exploded. Yeah. At one point, I could be wrong here, but I think that she was cross country, cyclocross and road. She like held all three jerseys at once. She's just,
dude, she's gnarly then.
She took some time off and then she came back and now she's, yeah, I think she's going to go back to road, but I think it's going to be Pauline wins. Puck is second. We'll see though. Puck is crazy good.
She has been taking some swings, right?
Ooh, yeah, she's good. And then honestly, this course, if I was like to design a course for Haley, it would have way more constant technicality. And I think that as technicality increases, it only benefits Haley. But having said that, I still think this course is a really good fit for her. Like, I think that she'll,
as long as there's no berms like in Brazil, right? We're good.
It's punchy. It's
I love her. She ripped. I want Team USA to win. Look, Blevins and Haley, let's fucking go. But I get what you're saying.
Yeah, she'll be very good on this course. Like, it's punchy, and she's really good at punchy stuff. So,
yeah, same thing, Spencer. Where are you at?
Yeah, I think it's gonna be hard to go against Pauline here. She's just had a slower start, and it seems like she's really trying to peak for the Olympics. So
She also kind of looks like she's just riding around out there a little bit right now, right? Like, she gets the lead. We got a minute. Fuck it. We're just going to hang out, you know? Like, it's pretty wild.
Can we touch on, before we cut off, can we touch on the other Americans really quick too? I think Riley, Riley's been firing. Like I said, we'll see if he can hold the peak. It'll be interesting to see how he can deal with like the big stage of racing with the elites. And that his first time ever doing that, he'll also be racing at the Olympics. That's a lot of pressure, but Riley, to Riley's credit, he's only proven that he can deliver under pressure so far. Like he hasn't proved otherwise. So I think that he's probably considered an underdog, relatively speaking, you know, being the young kid. So I would absolutely not be surprised if he was within 5th to 10th. I would expect him. I think I even expect him to be somewhere within there. He's that good. But that said, if he doesn't finish there, I kind of get it because it's like first time with the elites and all the pressure, but Chris, I think this course has Chris written all over it too. Like,
really
punchy. Oh yeah. Like, he's so good at punching. I don't know if Spencer's ever raced him. I haven't raced Chris, but I mean, I've watched it constantly. And
yeah, like in Brazil, when he just punched it over that rock and just got three people, like they were standing still.
If somehow you could make like a race, just like 40 20s or like, 20 20s, like 20 seconds on 20 seconds off, Chris would be the greatest in the world. Like, he would destroy everybody. So I think he'll do really good on this course. And I think that Chris also, he has a track record of just delivering under pressure. When pressure is higher, he does better. So I think Chris could be top five. That would be really cool. And then Sevilla, if you look at like how she's how consistent she's been, even though she's been like not prioritizing results and she's just like trying to let herself go down so she can build back up to a peak again, she's super consistent. Like, placing very
she
well.
She is slowly and going up the food chain.
It's crazy. And I feel like the sky's the limit with Sevilla. Like, she's very low on the trajectory that really has no end yet. Like, she's just beginning on that trajectory. And the one thing though is, and I could be totally wrong, Sevilla, if you're listening to this, but I feel like Sevilla is really good at stable climbs and ones that are a bit more like consistent effort that grind people down. And so I'm curious to see how she does on a Sergi course. All that said, I expect to see Sevilla within 5th to 10th. Like, I'm quite confident that she'll be there, and I could absolutely see a situation where she's in top.
Yeah, I wonder if there's ever been any selection process where they think about that. Like, they think more so than how the points have been or how their last results are. But yeah, I wonder if they're like, oh, okay, hey. We know that the profile of this course is going to be like this. This rider maybe hasn't been doing as well, or she hasn't been doing as well, but they're really, really good at these punchier courses. And I wonder if they ever think about that, or if they just kind of give everyone the benefit of the doubt and break it down. I looked up Nino. Nino has won twice, 2012 and 2016, Beijing and Rio. So he's a two-time Olympic champ.
Could be there.
He's the goat.
The goat. I mean, how could you? I don't know. I feel like, so then if it rains, who we pick in then? No, you know, is it change up your order, or are we still sticking the same? Really?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, Pitcock last to crash it.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. But he's also like, look at how good he is in cyclocross. He's very good at riding a bike that's like not doing well, right? In bad conditions. Like, that's like one of the things he's best in the world at. So yeah. I don't think it changes a whole lot because Victor's also really good in the mud. Nino isn't very good in the mud. Like, he's come out and said that. So maybe that affects there. But Chris has shown that he's really good in it. Riley has shown that he's really good. And Haley.
What is Riley's lap time to like the pro men?
I don't know. I'd have to look.
Even though he's had weird conditions difference, but you know.
In a lot of circumstances, they're just as fast. And they even have like, sometimes they have faster peak time. Like their fastest lap time of the race is sometimes faster in U23s than it is in elites.
Is that just because you don't have as much competition? You're kind of think, you know, you're not as worried someone's going to come and attack
I would
later
say
in the
that
race
would
as much,
be
maybe?
The exact opposite. They're more, if they had less competition, they should be going slower, ideally, or whatever. They make a break, get out in front and cruise it in rather than drilling it. I think it's mostly a maturity thing. Whereas the elites tend to just chill a little more. I mean, obviously not chill, but let the race come to themselves and play out rather than the younger juniors and the under 23 guys. I think if they're feeling good, they're attacking as much as they can and cycling through that stuff. And that's just part of the development process. And I think with everything, like some, even in moto, some kids will come out and who am I thinking of? Like a rookie outdoors right now. Yeah.
Looks exactly. They all kind of do it.
They'll and even fast. The future stuff, like where you see these.
And then.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Tomac first outdoor.
Exactly.
Daxton Bennick, that kid, right? Like he was crushing the Supercross Futures races recently. And now he's in the outdoors and he's just.
Yeah. Even Julien Bomaire came out first couple Supercross races this year. And you're like, holy smokes, leading laps. And you're like, man, this kid might be it. And then, I mean, stuff happens and that potential still might be there, but. It's that young buck mentality.
Yeah.
They send it.
Yeah.
So then maybe we need to change up. Maybe I'm going with Riley now. You know, I don't know. Maybe he might just fucking fire it off.
He could do really well. Yeah.
Yeah. It could be. Yeah. Fuck. I guess maybe after practice, like I need to put my picks in on the fantasy league, change it real quick. What's up? You know? Sure. Cool, you guys. I just want to thank you all for just doing this shit, right? Is there anything else we're missing? What do you think? I mean, I feel like we can go down deep rabbit holes right now, but
ripped a little pod, like another one off the old list and keep it rolling. We should have you back, Jonathan, if you're down for it, talk some numbers, crunch some numbers.
Yeah. Happy to be.
See what else we can get into.
I'm going to just redo my studio. Cause apparently
he's not the first guest that's come into here and had a better, nicer setup than we have. So it's okay.
I know Sebastian did come in firing.
Yeah, he was ripping. Yeah, that guy was on it.
Yeah.
He's cool, dude. He moved to neighbors recently.
I know. Are you guys hanging out? You guys on programs or what?
I sent him a DM. I was like, hey, man, if you ever want to ride, let me know. Like,
oh, Sebastian, we got it.
He just ghosted me hard. Yeah.
What a dick. What a dick.
He probably doesn't want to hang out with like a Lycra dude, you know, but I do wear baggies, Sebastian, if you're listening.
I'm going to send him this part. I'm so sending him this part. All right, you guys, that's episode 11. Thank you all for being here. Don't close your browser. We need to make sure this thing downloads. I have not. I put you guys all on pause. And like, subscribe, we're on the shit, YouTube, Spotify, Apple. I think there's a Google one. I don't know. Send it to everyone. Thank you all. Stoked to have you guys on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Later.